This is episode 3, Charlie, of Free as in Freedom. I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Free as in Freedom.
We're back with another talk from the
BozDem
2013.
Yep.
Policy and Legal Issues, DevRoom, as coordinated by Tom Marble with assistance from us and Richard Fontana.
Exactly. And this talk was the one that we have in this episode. I was going to say today, but then we get back into the... Anyway, in this episode, we have an episode on trademarks by Pam Chestick.
That's correct. A former attorney at Red Hat, and now in private practice, ready to tell you pretty much the basics of trademarks. I should warn people, if you already kind of know a lot about trademarks, this will probably be a little hot to you. It's really an introductory talk, but if you really don't know much about trademarks at all, this
or
might be useful.
If you want to hear, she talks about some of the legal cases. So even if you know the basic principles, you might be interested in hearing about some of the cases.
That's true. Towards the end.
And the beginning.
Oh, I guess. Well, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anyway, that's the story that you're going to listen to. And I listened to this without slides.
I also listened to it without slides. I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
I wondered what was on the slides, but not enough to make sure I could look at them.
And if we can collect the slides from Pam, which we expect we'll be able to, they'll be in the show notes.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us again in the Legal Issues and Policy Dev Room. And next up is Pamela Chester.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I'm Pam Chestick. I was formerly at Red Hat, and now I'm in private practice. I was at Red Hat for about 4 years, and first off, let me say, everything I know about copyright and open source I learned from Richard Fontana. I thought I understood it before that until I met Richard. But I do consider myself a bit of an expert on trademark law, and that's what I'm here to talk about, and the special challenges of trademarks and open source. So one of the things, so this is what you're here for. If this is not what you came for, then you can go someplace else. More batteries.
We do have to return the ones.
Okay.
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Stolen one.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the last one.
Okay. Great. Sorry.
There your backups.
Yep. Excellent.
So as I said, I'm a U.S. lawyer, so I necessarily have a U.S. perspective. And for those of you who know anything about trademark law, know that the U.S. has a pretty expansive view, more expansive than most other countries about trademarks. But there is a commonality to trademark law because it's all based on the same premise around the world, which is, you know, it's all about a consumer transaction, about consumer behavior. So there's a commonality that you'll find among all the laws. And so also for that reason, I'm trying not to sort of identify specifically any one body of law. I'm trying to speak on a fairly global level, but just with the sort of caveat that I am a U.S. lawyer. I'm not going to be talking about, you know, sections of the Lanham Act or sections of the EU directive or anything like that. I actually will be to some extent, but I really want to drill down more to sort of the fundamental level of we as consumers, sort of, you know, that trademarks are something that are common to all of our human experience, you know, our professional life or open source aside. We go into grocery stores and we buy food, and trademarks are a fact of our life, which is one of the reasons I like working with them so much is we all have a common experience, a common expectation. And so there is some sort of, you know, driven from your gut kind of feeling about what's going on with trademarks and what's right and what's not right and what's confusing. So what is different maybe, so trademark law and copyright law are different and protect different interests, and that's a pretty, maybe an obvious thing to say, but I think it's also a really important thing to keep in mind. A copyright really is more sort of a bilateral situation where I have a copyright and you may want to use it. And when we're talking about trademarks, there's a third player in that, and that's the consumer. And so trademark law is designed to protect the consumer. So what's interesting here is The consumer doesn't have any standing in a trademark lawsuit or doesn't have any standing in a trademark case, but it's the consumer that we're out to protect. And so it's the trademark owner who is put in the role of the protector of the consumer. So speaking for the consumer, even though the consumer isn't there for to have a voice, but that's what the measure of infringement is a consumer going to be confused? So there's this sort of weird, well, I always thought like was a weird dynamic of this. It's not just a two-party relationship that we're trying to figure out. There's this influencer of the consumer that is taken into account. And so trademark law kind of takes that into account in coming up with legal doctrine as this sort of third player. So one thing that, so we'll start with common, I kind of hear commonly, I don't have a trademark. If we're talking about an open source project name, people don't think of that as being a trademark. And we're going to start with the premise that it really is a trademark. And we're not going to, you know, we can argue the fringe and say whether it is or whether it isn't. But for today's purposes, we're going to say that it is a trademark. This is the world of trademarks as I see them. Or the world, let me say, the world of, you know, open source project names and trademarks. So maybe we have this kind of big circle that's just a project name and it's not serving a trademark function, just like a personal name may not serve a trademark function. Then there's this big green circle of trademarks, and in the middle of it, you know, it's this kind of small section of registered trademarks. This is a big difference in the U.S. The biggest difference between in how countries treat trademarks is in this green area, is how much protection do they offer to unregistered trademarks. So everybody's kind of similar, you know, everybody protects registered trademarks. That's easy. That's what we all tend to think about as what a trademark is one that you've gone to the government and said, you know, record this or grant me a right to use this trademark. But there is this huge body, and this is where most project names would fall, I argue, into this sort of area of the green area, where you maybe don't have a trademark registration, but nevertheless, we treat this name as a trademark right. And the reason I put a dotted line here is because that's kind of the ambiguous areas. Like, where's the line? What's the difference between a trademark and a name? We can have that conversation some other time if you want, but it's sort of too complicated for now. But we're just going to assume that all project names, everything that you think of traditionally as a trademark, as well as project names, are going to be in that trademark bucket. I hear this is, you know, a very common theme. I want everyone to use the name, and my response to that is really. Is that really true? And I challenge that, kind of falling back on sort of what's the difference between a copyright interest and what you protect with copyright, what copyright is for versus what a trademark is for. A trademark is protecting your good name. And so I was just watching a list that, and maybe there are people in the room who can sort of contribute. I was just watching a list where there was discussion of when there are malfeasers out there who are doing malicious things with your open source project, how do you stop them? The only tool you have to stop them with is the trademark. And so you go after them with, you know, a cease and desist letter or something like that. And we're talking about sort of pretty malicious behavior here. I don't know if anybody, do you have an example you'd like to share? Or?
Yes, well, I think the email you're referring to is one that I wrote. So the problem that lots of open source projects have had is with scammers setting up websites that are offering downloads. And the way this scam works is the scammer gets a deceptive domain name that incorporates your project name or sounds like a misspelling of your project name. Or they use Google AdWords or a similar mechanism to draw in people who are searching for software like yours. They direct them to their site and they offer to let the searcher download the software. But in order to get the download, they tell the user that they have to give some credit card details in order to verify their identity or possibly to pay the cost of the bandwidth. The user does that, they check a checkbox agreeing to the terms and conditions, they perform their download. But had they read the terms and conditions, they would discover that in three-point text at the bottom of page 45, there was a clause that said that this was a subscription they're purchasing, not a single download. And their credit card then gets charged every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks for a small amount of money until finally they're able to shut down the scammer from leaking money out of their bank account. Because the user agreed to some terms and conditions, And because the sites are usually structured in a way that is legally plausible, it's extremely hard to have them shut down quickly. And the way that we used to do this with OpenOffice, and I'm pretty sure Mozilla has done the same thing as well.
There's a section in my talk.
is to enforce the trademark, to send a trademark cease and desist letter against the company, and then to get them into a legal discussion that you want them to stop their behavior because they breached your trademark and your good name. And you are often able to shut them down completely on the basis of a trademark infringement, even though what you have is a trademark and not a registered trademark, because they are clearly using your name in a manner intended to deceive, which is the point you're getting at.
So,
what about forks of your software that you don't approve of? I own the copyrights registered with the USPTO on a name for an open source project.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that different companies, for specific reasons, are using my software, but a version that is outdated with a lot of known bugs. And they use it in their own products. And then people start using that. And I get all the support questions. So
that's actually my next slide, I think. Are there other questions? I did want to say at the beginning, please feel free to interrupt, and I really would like to have this interactive. It's much more fun for me if we have a conversation. Yeah.
How careful should a project be about choosing its name?
As unwilling as you are to feel pain if you have to change the name. So what happens is you pick a name. You go along merrily for a year or two, everything's fine, and then you get a cease and desist letter, and your name, you don't have a defense. It was someone who's using the name first, it's similar enough, and you're going to have to change your name. So, what's your pleasure? my feeling is it's always easier to pick a name that's clear before, but I also, working at Red Hat, we did that as part of our service, was to clear names, so it was a very low-cost option. If you have to hire a lawyer to do it, then it becomes much more expensive. Yeah.
If you're looking for a name that someone else is using, come to us. We're particularly skilled at choosing.
Yes.
If Mozilla thinks your name is great, then you shouldn't use it. Just somebody else.
And I want to say all the good names are taken. No. I will say, we would occasionally get into people would work on a theme, and some of the themes have been just mined to death, and you're never going to find a name there. So if you're they're riffing on a concept. And, constellations, forget it, they're gone. Don't try superheroes. Well, DC Comics would be unhappy with that to begin with. One time they were trying to do a musical composition theme. Those were all and it's awful to go I'm really sorry, but I can't approve that one either. But anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say one other factor that goes into choosing name. That's SLC, and so I deal with this too. If you pick something that you can't trademark, then you will not be able to stop anybody later on from using it.
Yeah.
It's generic.
Yeah. Name selection is there's only so much time. But
could you repeat that comment just for the?
I'm sorry. Yeah. The other thing was that you need to pick a name that you can protect. If you pick a name like a generic, that's a generic word. Then you can't stop other people from using it, and so you have
Windows.
No tool. I'm sorry?
Windows.
Windows, like Windows. Well, if you have a lot of money, then it might be possible. backwards, sorry about that. So this comes to your question, is what do I have to allow? And this one I'm gonna have to curb on my notes because it's, because I had to write it down. Because there's a decision, there's one decision on this subject that I'm aware of, and that's worldwide, and it was a decision that came out of Germany. The first part of the decision was, we'll talk about in a minute, which is a referential use of someone else's name, and I take that back. What the situation was that it was GPL v2 software that was used on a set-top box called Enigma. I think I have a slide. Yeah, I don't know if that's the right. Anyway, I found a nice picture that's at Enigma on their website. So, so in this decision, a German decision. So what happened was the software was on a set-top box. Someone modified the software. To use, I think, on a different, so it's a GPL v2 software, it's four set-top boxes, was modified to put on another set-top box. So the court held that the software could still be called Enigma as long as the essential function of the original software was identical and pre-existing third-party plugins still worked. And also only so long as the user met the conditions of the GPL. So it had to be, now I'm blanking on the terminology, a fair and honest use. I forget the name under German, what the phrase is under EU law. So there was some modification to the software, and the court said that was okay. You can still call it Enigma, even though there was some modification to it. And that was as long, and so it was, it served the essential function, and pre-existing third-party plugins still worked. Now that's the EU position on it. The US position, now again, just to maybe back up a little, I think it's very well settled at this point that the open source licenses themselves do not speak to trademark rights. It's a separate right that has to be analyzed separately. So I'm just looking at all of this under traditional trademark law standards. We're assuming, that's actually what I wanted to say, that was the point on this case, was they said, you know, GPL doesn't affect the trademark grant, different interests that the GPL is talking about, that's the copyright. So trademark we're looking at under traditional standard of law. Under the U.S., what I look at for an analogy is the law of sort of repair. And so, under U.S. law, you can do a little bit to sort of modify an object as long as it's clear to the end user that you have modified it. And this the case that the original case that it talked about was spark plugs. They were champion spark plugs. And someone, it was back in the day when you didn't throw out spark plugs, you cleaned them up and rejiggered them and made them work again. So that they were marked as reconditioned. And the court said, and Champion complained and said, that's a trademark infringement. Here are these inferior spark plugs that, you know, people think are ours, but you know, they're inferior. And the court said, no, they're marked as reconditioned, so it's acceptable. The consumer knows what they're getting. So that's kind of where, so we have, in Europe, we have a court that says you can, you know, as long as it still suits the essential function. And under U.S. law, we have this sort of, you know, as long as people are advised of the difference and are aware of the difference, then we are going to allow some modification and still continue to use the trademark. And it's been done, it's come up with reconditioned golf balls. I mean, it comes up every so often. So it's no case law other than the German case. There's nothing at all about open source software, no decisions at all about it. But I think, so that's the guidance. So I don't know if that kind of gives you at least a frame. I don't know that it answers the question, but it tells you, unfortunately there's no black and white there's no black and white answer.
The problem I have is that people say, there's a bug in your software.
Yeah.
And they say, but we fixed that 3 years ago, and they are still using that old version that is distributed by dozens of other companies, and I want to stop them from using that old version.
Yeah, I mean, if the fact is that it's... So your situation is a bit unusual because it is your software, but an older version, so that makes it a little more complicated than a true fork. Is what it sounds like.
So I changed from the LGPL to the AGPL, and companies continue using the LGPL version because, hey, it's free, we don't have to pay.
Yeah.
LGPL isn't open source anymore. They don't know anything about open source. But I want to stop people from selling my old version.
Yeah.
Because that gives me a bad name.
Yeah.
Because I know there are bugs.
Yeah, so this is the issue. I think we'll move on. Because we're kind of getting into your specific issue. There was a question. I thought there was a question in the back row, but was I? No. Yeah.
The thing that we talk about is only about modifications to the software.
Yes.
It's not that I can write a completely new software with the same functionality and quality.
That's very clearly just falls right in the area of trademark infringement, where we talk about the similarity of the mark and the similarity of the goods and services, and are they close enough, people will be confused. And that's when we're talking about clearing names, that's what we're looking at. I mean, I don't clear a name. I may find a proprietary software that's somewhat different. I may find, you know, if I have something that's on the operating system level and there's an application level software with the same name, I may say, nah, it's too close. That's that scenario. Other questions? Yeah.
Trademarks are divided into categories, is that right? And so you can use
a trademark that's already in use in a different category, because the idea is that it's dissimilar enough. So what sort of thing is in the same category as software, apart from software?
So I don't want to go too much into this, but the brief answer is you it's a similarity of the goods and services and whether a consumer would think they come from the same source or not. So, and that will depend on what the...
So there aren't set categories, it's just about a test of similarity.
This is where it gets into country specific. So in the U.S. we ignore the goods and services are put into what's called international classes. In the U.S. we completely ignore that. When we are doing analysis, we don't care what they are at all. Other countries very specifically have like tables and charts that say these two are confusing. So that's very country specific.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For those of us in the room who are law students, do you happen to know the name of the German case?
I actually have a copy of it, and I can, if you come up afterwards,
because
it has a jar, it's like in re s underline. I don't know what that means. Sorry, I'm not even familiar with German, how the way German captions work.
About the case in which the trademark, the name represents both, for example, both a protocol and a program, would you still use the trademark protocol respecting the protocol? Could they use, I mean, for example, ICQ or MSN or something like that? That you have a protocol, that's a messaging protocol or something like that, and you also have a program, that's a commercial program, that's using that protocol. What would allow? I mean, you for example, do a fork. Do a program that uses that protocol to connect to Microsoft Network, something like that. And you go with similar name as the protocol, which in fact is like imagine Skype, for example. You do a free Skype program that used the Skype protocol, but not the Skype program. Could you use something like that?
Again, it comes down to it. It really is fairly simple. You know, similarity of the name, similarity of the goods and services. So, I tend to avoid. I would counsel to avoid things like that because there is a possibility of confusion in that. But we'd have to get down to the real specifics of it. So what do you have to allow is on one end of the spectrum. So sometimes you may not want people to use your name, but under trademark doctrine, they are allowed to use it to some extent, even for modified software to some extent, perhaps. Maybe not in the U.S., maybe, you know. Again, I just want to point out the restrictions on the German case. This was also, you know, this was software designed to be used on a set-top box, so it was an embedded product. So, you know, I think maybe the analysis will be different if it was just a standalone program, but it's the only thing we have. So then when have you shared too much? So here we're back to, I want everybody to use my name. Okay, well, there is a theory that it's possible to share too much, and there was just a very recent decision in Greece which found that the Grüne Punkt trademark is invalid in Greece. The reason being it was over-licensed. There were too many licenses. And again, I have to refer to my notes to make sure that I get this statement correct. So for the Grüne Punkt, there were 95,000 licenses and 91% of Western Europe packaging used the mark. And so, under EU law, they held that this was not a genuine use as a trademark. In other words, what it means is this doesn't signify source anymore. It doesn't mean anything. People just understood this to be, it means it's recyclable. It didn't identify, trademark identifies a single source, a sole source. This didn't do that anymore because it became so ubiquitous, so commonplace that it became meaningless. So it didn't serve its function as a trademark. So this is, I frankly thought this doctrine was something that I was never going to see outside of the United States, and lo and behold, a few days ago, the Grüne Punkt
What was it supposed to do, that trademark?
Well, I mean, I argue, do you know, I mean, is it the question, what is the Grüne, are you familiar, you're familiar with the Grüne Punkt?
No.
Oh, okay. So the Grüne Punkt is, basically, it's a shakedown. Sorry, I'm an American, that's the way I think of it. where you would pay a licensing fee in order to put this mark on the product, and as a result, and actually, is there someone who knows better than me, someone more familiar with it, and either some amount of money was contributed towards recycling, is that what it is? Some amount of money is contributed to recycling. when you use this mark. Yeah.
It symbolizes the recycling of the product, or the packaging of the product, rather, is ensured.
It symbolizes that the recycling of the product is ensured, that this product will be recycled. But there was a financial component to that too. But at any rate, but it was became so commonplace that it failed to serve its function as a trademark any longer. So that's under the U.S. law, we have this great doctrine called naked licensing. It's the same idea, which is where you grant a license to your trademark, but you don't control how people are using it. Anybody can use it any way they want. It becomes meaningless as a source identifier, and that, so it's called a naked license. There's some very bad case law in the United States I find personally it's kind of gone way off the rails, where they've taken this sort of control concept too literally. And they found it's a case called about free cycling, where it was a very scary case to me, because free cycling is a sort of a philosophy where I guess people exchange stuff for free. I don't even know what it is. But there were various chapters set up, and they were organized in Yahoo groups. And basically, they let anybody use the trademark. Anybody could set up a group and say, hey, I'm a free cycling group. I'm, free cycling San Bernardino. And they would say, great, you're a free cycling group. And there was no more control than that exercise. And the court said that was a naked license, that there was no free cycle trademark, that trademark was unenforceable. It wasn't serving its function as a trademark. I strongly disagree with the court on that reasoning, but it's there. What can you do about it? I don't know. I don't know the answers. We have we have a couple data points. We have De Grüne Punkt, which said too many licenses. We have a concept in the United States of a naked license, which is if you don't control it, you're not going to have a license. But I also just saw in the Enigma decision, actually, there was a comment that. Again, talking about very widely licensed software, and they said, well, this is a positive thing. Everybody's familiar with Enigma, so it therefore has meaning. And I'm like, I don't get it. It doesn't, I can't put all of this together. So it's very kind of ambiguous what's going on. I mean, I have no idea what to tell people about how to kind of do this. The thing that bothers me the most about open source, free and open source software doesn't bother me about the software, it bothers me the legal interpretation that may happen, is trademark law developed in a system, in a corporate system. It developed out of first the tradesmen, and then you have corporations, and it doesn't even really, trademark law really doesn't even cover a multinational corporation very well. It does a very poor job kind of recognizing even sort of a multinational corporation that has many subsidiaries around the world, of sort of dealing with that. And so when you get into an open source environment where you have a very distributed control structure, trademark law doesn't like those situations. It wants to see you are a company that owns a trademark. And the idea of having sort of maybe multiple contributors or multiple people who might have a say in the operation of this organization is just not something that trademark law has ever seen. And so I'm really, and when I did see it, this free cycle case coped with it very, very badly. And so that's, so when people, you may consider me to be sort of overly protective, and that's my reason for it, is the trademark law just isn't ready for us.
You're seeing your agenda. We are seeing your agenda.
Oops.
You're trailing my talk. Thank you.
I am. Let me get back to you. Oh, wait a minute.
Click remind me again in 5 minutes, and then you can trail it again.
Yeah. Actually, I'm trying to get back to my... how do I get... You know what I can't do? Wait, there we go.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I am in prison 12. Sorry about that.
You can exit and go back in.
Yeah.
So do you think that there would be a difference for a project if there is aggregated copyright or a nonprofit foundation or even a for-profit company that's promoting the open source project versus a inbound equals outbound project?
Yeah. I think the more it's much easier to identify who an owner is if there's a copyright ownership that rides with it. Right, so it is easier to say, look, there's the owner. I mean, the question, the, one of the fundamental questions, this is an area I write about a lot, is how do you decide who owns a trademark? And, you know, a lot of it has to do with sort of exercise of control. And so if you can say, look, there's a copyright owner, I think it's easy to say, oh, look, they must be exercising control because they're, you know, if there's, you know, I don't worry too much about Linux because, you know, there is a very fairly small level of control over who gets to commit. So, you know, if there's a lot of committers, then a lot of say. I mean, just the more distributed it gets, the more concerned I am that that the, you know, it's just going to be difficult to say kind of who gets to control that. Let's see.
But you said before that it was reasonably widely accepted that the set of rights associated with copyright and trademark were separated. So Tom's question kind of conflates the two together again. So I would have been more, let's say, relaxed if your question would have been, is it better if there is a single trademark owner? Because you're putting again together the aspect of copyright ownership and a trademark ownership. So what is what?
Good point. And I was thinking, what I was saying was, so in terms of the license itself, the license itself does not speak to a trademark license. It's only a copyright license. It's very, very possible that the trademark and the copyright will not be owned by the same person in an open source environment. Figuring out who the trademark owner is incredibly challenging sometimes, and there may not be a clear answer under sort of traditional doctrines. So the point of the copyright owner is it's easier. It's kind of a data point for me that says, oh, wait a minute, here's somebody who I can see exercising control, therefore maybe that's also the trademark owner, but it isn't necessarily going to be the case.
So does only the owner have standing to do anything about trademark?
I'm sorry?
Does only the owner,
yes,
in that context have standing to do anything?
Yes, only
so
the owner has standing.
If you picked up maintainership of a project that somebody else started, they're presumably, they named it, they're presumably the person in control, but they're not interested in doing the project anymore. So you then can't do anything on trademark.
You'd have to make an argument that somehow the ownership of the trademark transferred to the new maintainer. And what happens is that these relationships aren't done with documentation. It just happens. And then that becomes very challenging. And it, just from a legal perspective, it's much better if you have a piece of paper that says, you know, this is yours now. And that's true of many, many things, true of houses, you know, it's true of a lot of things, right? But it tends to not happen with trademarks a lot, and that is something courts have to spend a lot of time sorting out. Remember what I said about the naked licensing. I was just talking in these cases kind of about the primary goods, and kind of I've been talking generally here just about the software itself, just the primary good itself. I don't even want to get near like t-shirts and mouse pads and keychains, because I have no idea, because this same standard that said you have to control the quality of the goods, okay, I get that for software, that makes sense to me, but you're going to tell me that I've got to control the quality of a t-shirt? I don't know how to make a t-shirt. I just send it to go to Cafe Press and ask them to print my logo on there. Like, but that's the U.S. standard of law, which is kind of out of whack. So I'm not even, like, I don't even know what to do with that one. Because, you know, but if that's what the law is. Just to add one more complication to this whole thing, which is trademark law only stops confusing uses. I thought this might have been where your question was coming from, but you can always use it, you can always talk about someone else's product. You can always say, and we have to do that, we have to say that, you know, I'm compatible, that I run on top of. Yeah.
So does that mean when I get a letter from some film company saying, you know, we want to use, we want someone to use Firefox in our film, right? They don't need to ask under trademark law, because there's no way that could confuse someone into using a browser that isn't Firefox and thinking that it's Firefox.
You know, the answer to that 10 years ago would have been clearly you don't need permission, but as people have started to ask permission, people start to think you need permission, and consumers start to get confused, and we know about endorsements in movies, we know that companies pay to have their products placed in movies, and so the industry has started to blur that line. And I would prefer that we not, I would prefer it we be nice and clean and we say, no, of course you don't need a license because there's no confusion there. But with product, and it's cases come out on both sides of that, and we can talk about that. The lawsuits that are brought are where someone is put in a disparaging light, and they complain about it, and that's where you see the litigation is when it's a disparaging use.
Related to that question, what about the case of the Windows logo compatibility test or things like that?
Logos.
You need a certain amount to compete with a certain amount of conditions to actually be able to display that law.
Yeah, because under U.S. law, you are only allowed to use as little as necessary to convey the information. So under U.S. law, I consider it to be a pretty bright line, and this is the way I counsel people: is you don't get to use the logo. Because you can say Windows, and that will express it. And Microsoft has a licensing program for the logos, and then you have to go in and sign a license in order to be allowed to use a logo. So I think there's some discontinuity between what the law says and what we see in practice, because we've become so used to seeing little icons, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all of those, that now at this point, like, the law would say, oh no, you have to use the word Twitter. And I'm like, that's crazy. But, you know, so it's where the business operates. It's kind of differently from the way that the law currently stands.
So one thing would be the trademark, and another different thing would be a logo or an icon.
Yes, logo or icon design form, probably there is no, you don't get to use it under this, you know, this theory, that's this referential use theory. We get to talk about it.
Isn't the Windows, it's a certification mark, isn't it?
That's one of them, but I'm not sure the parameters of what else there might be besides just having to sign the license agreement. It might be self. I don't know. Is there a test suite?
Yeah.
But you could still talk about the certification program and use the certification logo while talking about the certification logo.
If you needed to talk about the logo itself,
yeah,
you could use the logo. Other? All right, what are we going to next? So to distill this all down into basic principles, you can't exercise full control. You have to, there's some degree of modification that you have to permit, but we don't know how much that is. You can't exercise too little control, because then you lose your trademark rights, but we don't know how much that is either. And then we have to respect referential uses. We have to respect that other people's right to say that, you know, X is compatible or so forth, but that doesn't include the logo. So
is that the same thing as
nominative?
Yeah.
I tend to not use that phrase. That is, it's nominative fair use is the doctrine under U.S. law. That's the name of it. Where do we go from here? And this is kind of, you know, the audience participation part of this is, I mean, just like the open source community sort of affected copyright law and the interpretation of copyright law, I think that can happen with trademark law. You know, what are the ways to sort of create a system because what does happen is, you know, we're back to consumer confusion and sort of how an industry behaves does affect. If you can go into a court and say, look, this is the industry understanding of how things work, nobody's confused here, we all understand this, then we have the opportunity to kind of shape what happens. So I think what I would like to see is sort of consistent behavior or consistent understanding on what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. What is an appropriate way for other people to use your trademark, but not in a way. Let me back up a little bit. So one of the questions I have is kind of back to the beginning is, how would you not like your trademark to be used? Because my feeling is that there is that desire to not have your trademark used in certain ways, and if you exercise that control, that's going to be good enough for trademark law so that you don't lose your right to your trademark. So let me propose the question to you is, what way would you see your project name used that would be harmful or offensive to you? And one example was using an older version, you know, an outdated version that was, you know, that was buggy. What other ways? And we had used maliciously for, you know, other companies using them maliciously and nefariously.
I will talk about VLC because we have some issue with people doing that, but they are bundling VLC with some toolbars and some scams, spyware and things, and distributing for free on the internet. And this is one of the things we're trying to fight, but it can be very hard because we have millions of users, so it's a way for them to earn a lot of money.
Yeah. So let me ask, if someone, how far could someone modify your software and you would be okay with it? And when would you, because I just have to think there's some point where it gets modified when you're like, that's not even the same thing anymore, or that reflects badly, or...
At least for us, the difficulty is that it's not about necessarily the level of modification, it's about what you change, right? So a single addition to the list of trusted certificate authorities in Firefox is like, whoa, right? Similarly, removing entire web features. This is Firefox, but it doesn't run WebGL. Or this is Firefox, right? Bad. But on the other hand, there are more extensive changes that you might make that we might easily come to an agreement with you that you could make. You know, so for example, if you were an ISP and wanted to do a customized version of Firefox, you might do quite significant changes to the interface or perhaps to the default bookmarks or to the bundling. I mean, we don't do that sort of thing these days so much, primarily because we haven't got time. But, you know, those did happen in the past. So it's not about the amount of modification, it's about what you do, and that makes it very hard.
So let me break this out into two parts. One part is, what are you going to say publicly, sort of essentially post a public license equivalent, to say, if you do this, we're cool with that and you can use the name, versus a negotiated agreement. In a negotiated agreement, you can do anything you want, and you can say, you know, I don't care if, you know, whatever, you know, whatever horrible thing you want to call it, Firefox, you're good with that. You actually don't risk the validity of your trademark doing that. You risk your brand, you know, the value of your brand when you let bad things happen, but you don't risk your trademark from a legal perspective. So I'm more in the sort of public license arena. I know Mozilla is one of the better ones at sort of saying what it is you're allowed to do and still call it Mozilla. And it's pretty limited, but there is some, you give some latitude. I mean, there's one, you know, one position is you can't change a single bit and still call it the original project. And I've seen people take that position. Yeah.
Well, on this point, I think there is a specific issue with trademarks and open source software, which is that you might not change the software at all, like the source code, but you might rebuild the source code in a different setting, obtaining a problem which is completely different and has different bugs. Okay, and I've tried to figure out in the past the answer to the question: could trademark law inhibit this kind of mere recompilation or not? Because your name, Firefox, is the name of the open source project. I guess for you is the name of the software, of the source code.
Yeah.
So I can rebuild in a completely different setting, obtain a completely crappy Firefox.
It's the name of the resulting software. The source code has some other name.
So if you have some insights on this question, I would
that's actually, I mean, that's one of the things I wanted to find out was sort of, is, you know, is it fair to say if I take the source code and build it for a different environment, is it fair to still call it by the same name or not? I mean, poll the audience. How many think that if you just build for a different platform, then you should still be able to use the original name? I'd say more than half on that one.
But that might have negative reputation effect on...
Well, and that's what I'm saying. It's like if we as a community can come together, I'm not saying necessarily agree, but at least to have some commonality on what we think is okay, then we have the opportunity to sort of shape that.
I think it's more like the Mozilla guy said, it's more like about the functionality than about the changes you make. And you can rebuild it in a different environment with different libraries with same API and have totally different functionality.
Yeah.
Intended or not. I mean, you could change the certificate authority without modifying a source line of the source code, and maybe modifying it in the OpenSSL library or something like that. So I mean, you could still use the same source code as it is, and provide different functionality.
Yeah.
So, Because I think this relates to the question as before. When I have a trademark, or you have a name, what does the name refer to? And it's a big question in this case. Does it refer to the source code, to the binary, to the organization project, to the functionalities?
It can be all of the above.
And it can be different ones at different times, right?
Yeah.
The Firefox trademark started off as this binary browser, but we are engaging in expanding the meaning of that trademark to cover additional activities that we're doing, such as Firefox OS, right? So the thing that a trademark means in the mind of consumers can change over time, and it can be driven by the organization that owns that trademark in different directions over time.
And by outside forces. The situation that always comes to mind for me is Java, because Java has so many different meanings, and Java means a language, and there are no trademark rights when you're referring to Java as a language, but Java as a virtual machine is a tightly controlled trademark by Oracle. So it just depends on what the trademark is and how it's being used, but it can refer to many different things.
So is there any doctrine already on this aspect, on the recompilation or not, or
no.
Nothing at all?
No, we're making it up here. It's you guys.
Yay.
Are it.
In that case, though, is that something you're precedent to use in Germany?
Yes. And to the extent that you think the Enigma decision was wrong or too expansive or allowed too much modification and still be called Enigma, I thought that might be an overexpansion. Under U.S. law, I would have expected them to say you can't use the Enigma trademark. So that's why I said, it was kind of an unusual situation that it was an embedded software, and so maybe you can limit it to that. And there was some language in the decision that maybe allows you to restrict it to its facts so that it wouldn't, to the extent you don't think it's right, that it wouldn't necessarily bleed into other types of software. But I don't know if there's an opinion on Enigma. Enigma, is that right, or the legal standard in Enigma right? No, not getting many hands on that one. Yeah.
So I was going to ask, in the light of the Enigma decision, do you think it's worthwhile documenting what the essential functionality of your application or your software product is so that you can refer to that later? I mean, Mozilla would take its list of trusted certificates.
It would be a long list if
yeah.
we had to document all of the essential function of a web browser.
Would that be worthwhile?
Well, if you end up writing a trademark policy, you're gonna end up writing what you think is fine for you to be changing, what is not. So
yeah, and that's actually, I mean, I put together I don't know what my last slide is. Yeah, model trademark guidelines, which I had kind of started as a project, and it hasn't really come very far. But that's kind of one of the reasons I'm here is, and one of the things that I realized as I was doing this is that answer is very unique, I think, for certainly different layers of the stack. It's going to be very unique, and then even, for project to project. So I think the answer to that particular question, you're right, that's probably going to be embodied at some place in the guidelines, as Mozilla has done. But I also think it might be unique. But if we can come to sort of some agreement on what that is in a model trademark guidelines, I think that would be helpful. I don't know where to go. How about over here? Yeah.
Can trademark law protect something that's not necessarily directly user visible, like something as primarily machine readable? A program looks up a cryptography service, and there's a name of that cryptography service that says Microsoft Cryptography Service or Mozilla Cryptography Service. Can you go replace?
I have the same question almost, so I might ask it at the same time. Say the trademark of Sendmail. Say they have a trademark on Sendmail, the company name. It's also the name of their product. When you invoke Sendmail from the script, you put Sendmail. If some other mailer program wants to have a send mail link that says actually call my program, is creating that a trademark infringement or is it nominative use? Because it's actually referring to something completely different by the same name, but then again it's an interoperability issue. So that's something that's related to
there's another doctrine called functionality, which says to the extent that I have no choice but to do this, then I get to do it. So you can't use a trademark as a lock on something. To the extent it turns into a lock, then people have to be able to use it to unlock the lock. And the case that I get that from is was a game controller, Sega.
Nintendo was that?
No, I think it was Sega, because they were using the letter string.
It was Nintendo who was suing Sega over the use of the name Nintendo.
There are two cases.
Two cases. Okay. All right. Well, we're all right. but I have the doc. I have the theory right. Right. Is to the extent that you try to lock it by using a trademark, you can't enforce your trademark against that.
But in the SendMail case, suppose you make a malicious program called SendMail, but it's not something someone would ever type. Say it's only called by a script. I mean, I guess my question has to do more with machine visible versus.
I think that in that situation, I think that you're probably going to be less successful on a trademark law theory, and more successful on other types of legal theories. Which, you know, doesn't mean you wouldn't necessarily bring it, but you may not.
You're almost suggesting that SendMail's command line API is an API in the sense of the EU interoperability.
A command line API is very much an API.
I would agree.
I think it's very hard to argue that it's not. It's a set of parameters by which you control the program. It's an API. Much more so than a GUI.
Do we have one more question?
Let's take two more. One in the back here and two more.
I got two in the back.
Yeah,
in the corner there?
This is related to the same question. So many years ago, I don't know if there was ever a lawsuit, but in Finland we had SSH, the company who originally created SSH. And they wanted on trademark grounds ban the OpenSSH project from producing a binary with the same name. And just pointing it out because this at least is something you wouldn't most of the time use from a script. It's something people actually type as a name.
But it was also used as a marketing name. It was also visible as a marketing name.
It was a company name and a trademark company.
That's the easy case. It's where it's invisible to the users, it becomes more challenging. Because the trademark is meant to be, you know, it's part of a commercial transaction, right? So if it's not, that was the whole role of a trademark, is it helps guide a commercial transaction.
But I can't remember now why. So the end result, of course, is that we do have OpenSSH and the name that you type on the command line is the same. But I don't remember at what point.
How it got there?
Maybe they just, their own
lawyer
said that you don't have a chance, or I don't know why.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're all drifting a bit into specificity, actually, but I wanted to go back a bit and have more like an overview for me. I take from this talk that we seem to have legislation which was formulated and defined with all its terms, maybe 100 years ago more. Which was mainly dealing with hardware, objects, and trade goods, and now we try to fit this new phenomenon, so to say, which is software, which is something more floating and more changing and reshaping over time. It's like almost like property compared to hardware. Seems like there's some struggle, and you, for example, your profession seems to struggle a lot about to fit. This is something that is almost like alive into the static legislation, and that seems to be, for me, it seems to be the reason why it is difficult, because I think it is impossible maybe. And do you see any reform which could? Have you any perspective on how this shift in paradigm actually, which took place practically before the legislation was adapted, could be resolved?
So in the U.S., the legislation was passed in 1946. There's two philosophies of legislation, and one is you say very little and let everybody, you know, the courts interpret it, and that's the philosophy behind this particular the Lanham Act in the United States. And I actually think that they've done a fairly good job of because we have this latitude. If you read the Lanham Act, you wouldn't have a clue what trademark law is. It's all court. Developed over time, but I think it's done a good job of keeping up. I don't think that what is happening in software or open source is any more challenging than is happening in other fields too. It's the nature of, you know, nature of the world that we advance, and you know, so to say the answer is no. I don't see any desire in the United States to amend the legislation. Everybody seems perfectly happy with it, and we'll just keep, you know, bumbling along and figuring it out as we go. I think that's all the time we have.
Yep, thanks, Pam.
Thank you very much.
So Karen, I have to admit something. I hope Pam won't be offended, but the trademark talk you gave, I liked better.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was a different style of talk.
That's true.
Like mine was more like practical advice for free software developers.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, that was more of a kind of a, Pam's was kind of more of a lawyer's talk.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was kind of like a class. It was kind of like a trademark
class.
I felt like it was. Mm. I felt like it was like teaching. I'm looking now to find the. There was an episode. We made an episode out of that talk of yours.
Did we?
I think we did.
Because I gave it. It was like either. It was at one of the Linux Foundation events in San Francisco. I remember that.
Yeah. What
and
year
it wasn't
was
that,
that
long ago. It wasn't that long ago. You can probably just search for trademarks now.
Yeah, what year was that? Was that a long year ago? A long year ago? Was that many years ago?
It wasn't many years
many
ago.
Many years ago.
No, I was already working at GNOME, and because I talked about the mixed use logo, the mixed logo of the Debian Swirl.
50 years ago.
the Debian Swirl plus the GNOME foot.
Yeah, you did. I remember that.
So
did
that
am I
was
talking
already
people?
At GNOME.
Maybe we didn't make that a show.
And Conservancy was already participating in the Outreach Program for Women because I announced that at the beginning of the
talk. So that must have been 2012.
Well.
And so yeah. Maybe we never... But here's Richard's talk.
Ah, we only released Richard's talk from that...
Oh, no, that's horrible. And so now we've said this.
Because
yeah.
We were going to do his FOSDEM talk instead, but he gave the same talk and he asked for us to use his LinuxCon talk instead.
Yeah, it's true.
So, but there was an article about my talk on LWN.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking. So we'll link to that article so you can at least read about Karen's talk. I guess we didn't record it. Maybe
I was very practical. I gave a lot. I gave like free software examples that you may know about, kind of thing.
Maybe
I got
to
talk about fish pedicures, which I always.
I remember that too. So so we'll give a link to that in the show notes, and I think that was a really good talk on trademarks. And
thanks.
I guess we never broadcast it because maybe I have a recording of it on some hard drive somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe I did record it. Do you remember a microphone being in front of you?
Yes, it was definitely there.
Oh.
But I think there was some problem with some of the recording that day. Anyway.
So we're sorry if you never heard that talk, but there is an article about it. I think
yeah.
That's right. Let's make sure that's true. Do you remember that, or you remember that for sure?
I'm positive. Because it was sent to me much later,
okay.
And I was taken by surprise.
Why were you taken by surprise?
I'm always surprised when anybody wants to talk about the things that I do or say. I don't know why that's the case, since, you know, I give talks all the time, and, you know, the things that I work on I consider to be very important, but...
Okay, well, it's, but yeah, so I think Pam, but instead of talking about your talk
you'd
more,
have to look for trademarks and
well,
my name.
Well, I haven't found it. So,
if you just search for my name and
okay,
trademarks.
Okay, fine. But
I know this makes for great listening.
And indeed, it was 2012.
Yeah.
Indeed, there is an article about it that we'll
link
to in
the show
notes.
It was the Collaboration Summit, not LinuxCon.
Collaboration Summit, and so Karen gave that talk more on, it was more a free software project centric talk, I think.
It's because, you know, I mean, from my perspective, that's where, you know, that's where I was coming from, having worked at SFLC and, you know, been advising different free software projects about their trademark stuff. It, you know, this was, that's more of where I found interest, but Pam has a completely different perspective, having been inside a big company.
Well, yeah, and also coming from Nike and sort of being a trademark lawyer for some big, powerful, evil corporation, trademark brand kind of thing, and then learning about the free software stuff after that. I think probably some of the stuff that she brings up, I think we do need to talk about in some sense. Because
I thought it was very interesting to hear her say, you know, hear her talk about whether or not the way that we use marks is trademarks and logos is changing, and whether the law will change flexibly around that. Because she had it both ways in her talk. She said that on the one hand, you know, the law was very strict about certain things and it's just the way it is. And then on the other hand, she said, you know, in a lot of ways, trademark is in the eye of the beholder. It's about whether consumers will be confused or not. And she also said that the ways, you know, the the understanding that businesses have about the way logos and trademarks will be used has changed fundamentally, so that it's stepped away from the law. And since that, you know, there's that flexibility within the law, I think there's a really strong argument to be made that our, you know, our norms are changing, and that ultimately the law will have to reflect that.
Well, I worry when, and we'll hear other talks later in this series where people are saying, oh, well, the law's going to have to change, or you're going to have to change, and one of them's going to have to happen. And that's not what I'm saying. Yeah.
What I'm saying is that the whole point of trademark law is all structured around the idea of whether or not consumers will be confused, right?
Yeah, and consumers are more savvy, basically.
And it's not just that consumers are more savvy, it's just the way that we refer to products has changed.
Yeah, I mean, she did make that point about the about Twitter and Facebook being being completely iconic.
Exactly, and that you actually, to refer to them, you use the picture. You use the logo when you refer to them, potentially. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just sort of an expected thing. And consumers, the public, is not going to be confused to think that just because you use the little Twitter logo that you are affiliated with Twitter. Everybody knows that if you put the little Twitter logo, it just means you should click it and go to Twitter.
Other microblogging services are available.
Yeah, but I mean, but Identica doesn't have this little, you know, doesn't have a little that's logo
little
that's everywhere.
Status, kind of bubblies.
It does, but it's not the same kind of, like, you know, iconic logo that has established a law. You know, I'm not saying it doesn't have trademark protection. It surely does from its use, but the way that you see the Twitter mark used is not, you know, there are alternatives to Twitter, but the example of the logo is not translatable to Identica.
See, I think Leo Laporte should have enforced his Twit trademark against Twitter when they started.
You've said this many times.
I have. I never said this on the Oddcast.
Is that true?
I don't think so.
Okay, you may have said it on.
But I think he should have, because it just would have been funny. I think the place where it's really helpful to hear from a traditional trademark lawyer who's learned recently about free software, like Pam is, I think her main question was very useful. Her main question was, free software developers need to think about uses you don't like. And she had this point that there are uses you don't like. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually true.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think most free software projects are not the way she was describing. Like, we just want them to use the name. She's right that there are uses they wouldn't like, and if you can define those uses you don't like, your trademarks are you can protect them and uphold them.
Well, that's like, you know, every time you put to, I mean, it's a good idea to come up with a trademark policy, because right. When you do, I mean, my old standard trademark policy, which I think you drew from when you made Conservancy's trademark policy, but mine had different areas for discussion. You know, it had, like, how do you feel about this usage and that usage and this other usage?
Yeah, that's part of the, like, the email that they get sent now.
Yeah. So, I think you got to bake that into the basic discussion about how you want, you know, how you want to use your mark and what you expect from your trademarks.
Yeah.
We don't need to look at it.
I just want to see if, so we forked this from somewhere, so I don't know where it was forked from. Sorry.
From me.
Okay.
I think so.
Yeah, I was looking at the
although there's
material
it's not
log
really that
the,
recognizable. So yeah. Maybe Tony took it from something he had used before.
I don't know. But we could read all the logs here. We could.
But
read,
I do know that
would
there
our
was...
listeners. Do you think our listeners would enjoy us reading commit logs from?
Definitely.
Oh, see,
not.
This was like a big reorder of the repository there. So who knows where it came from? I'd have to chase that with follow copies and.
Let's not.
Okay. Well, I mean, we could make this a tutorial of how to chase something down in a repository history.
I don't think that our listeners would. I think
some of our listeners actually would like that, but they not
would.
On a trademark
it's
show.
It's pretty off topic for us.
It's true. So I think that it's valuable that this talk, I think, was actually very valuable. And I hope that folks who didn't know very much about trademarks were able to learn something about them. Because we have gotten requests, even recently, of folks looking for more basic information on our Oddcast. And I think Pam's talk really serves that well. And in some sense, your talk, the one I like so much, was kind of a more advanced talk for free software developers.
It's funny
about
because
trademarks.
In some ways it was more basic and in some ways it was more advanced, I think.
Well, it was more advanced because you were talking about projects that had already thought about these questions and working through those kinds of trademark issues.
Yeah, and just showing examples of what really can go wrong and how to work through that.
Yeah, it's more of a thing. So one of the things that troubled me that Pam said was that she said that having the copyright hold, well, she said owner, which I don't know, but I'll say it the way I would say it, holding the copyrights as well as the trademark somehow helps your trademark enforceability, and that really disturbed me.
I think you could make an argument that if they're centralized holding a copyright, it often would correspond to trademark enforceability because you have a central control over, you know, like an identifiable source of the software. You know, I mean, and I say source just
yeah, that's
from
the way she said
trademark.
It as well.
Exactly,
that's the way she said
exactly.
It as well.
So I think
let's talk about it. Yeah, Pam said source multiple times in her talk, and yes. Karen's now using it in the same way Pam did, which she means origin.
Yes.
Not source code.
Yes. So I think she's right. Even if it's just in practicality, because if everybody is assigning their copyrights to a single copyright holder, it's much easier to assert that that entity also has the mark because there's a certain amount of control over the software.
But you don't find that
and the use of logos.
If true, don't you find that disturbing?
No, because trademark is like one of those like shades of gray kind of like, you know, types of law. It's about confusion and, you know, I just think if, you know, a strong agreement amongst a community over what, you know, what to do with the trademark, so like a single trademark policy that everyone assents to, or, you know, like whether it's not actual assent, but, you know, maybe not written collected assent in an agreement or anything like that, but even just, you know, a de facto assent by anything that you can show that is a centralized use of the mark or permission, the kinds of permissions that you would grant with a trademark policy, make it a little bit easier to enforce. Because otherwise you could say, well, you have all these different entities that are using the license. You didn't register as a certification mark. So, you know.
Oh, what do you mean by didn't register as a certification?
So you're not making a certification mark.
Oh, is that a separate? So, is that like trademark service marks and then there's also a certification mark?
Certification marks are a little bit different.
Yeah, because Pam didn't talk about those. So
right.
Now that you've said it, you have to explain it.
So it's just a certification mark is like a mark like you might see, you know, there are marks that can be used by other people with, you know, if they meet certain criteria. So for example, I think OSI's logo is a certification mark.
Actually, maybe a better example that our listeners would know is USB.
Or
because that's probably a certification mark.
Or like the Cardiac Association approves certain breakfast cereals and things like that. Like it's all over the place. There's, you know, and if you see like seals of approval and stamps that are certifying.
Good housekeeping seal.
Exactly,
of approval.
Exactly. Things like that. They certain and there are criteria in order to.
And by the way, the good housekeeping seal of approval is bullshit because a lot of products I bought that say good housekeeping seal of approval are crap products. I have to say, I don't trust those people. They have a bad.
Well, mind. If they're giving out their mark too much, you know, and they don't have control over the quality, it could be.
No, I think it's more that they just they give it to the highest bidder.
Well, so there's often a financial component, but there it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, usually there have to
so
be.
So what you're
standards.
Saying is if there's lots and lots of copyright holders and lots of people offering services and support around the software, you're saying that the
sometimes
trademark?
A certification mark makes a lot more sense because there are strict guidelines for different people to use those marks.
So do you think that's what free software projects should get instead of regular trademarks?
I think so. It depends on.
Did you just think of this, or you thought about this before?
No, I've thought about this many. I actually question copyrights. Creator endorsed mark is a
cert mark.
Yeah, exactly. So it's something I've really thought about in the past. But it just depends on how the mark is going to be used and by whom and for what purpose, and what you think the likelihood is of confusion and of lawsuits.
Well, I think it's unlikely that. Free I have some probably more than many other people in the free software world, maybe a lot of people in the free software world, I've helped free software projects use their trademarks, and people love to talk to me about how Conservancy does GPL enforcement. We actually do some trademark enforcement as well.
GNOME does some trademark enforcement all the time.
Yeah, but we do it for like a lot of different projects, and the number one request is something to do with people being on Twitter, either saying they're the project or getting the project's name out from under
and
them.
And Twitter has so, criteria that
yeah, and you can use the trademark to get yep. to get to end stuff and yep. change stuff and all that. So but that's the number one request by far. But that's outclasses all the other issues
combined.
And I would
say that trademark work is probably the top legal amount of legal work that I do for GNOME Foundation.
Yeah.
That, you know, otherwise I'm mostly doing non-legal stuff.
Right.
I have some nonprofit stuff.
But the thing is that basically community misrepresentation is the biggest thing they want to prevent. And notwithstanding that you can get Twitter to do what you want pretty much with your trademark and get your Twitter accounts back.
Back to Twitter.
But my point is that notwithstanding that, enforcing community representation of people saying I'm from the project when I'm not, or saying they are the project when they're not, that's not trademark's not the best at that in some sense.
Well, it depends. I mean, I think that there are times when trademark is very useful for that.
Oh, I mean, it can help, but it's not what it's designed for.
Truthfully,
really.
Usually it's like, you know, like anything else, you implore people to do the right thing and they often do.
Mm-hmm.
And especially people who are, you know, dabbling in a community, if they make it seem like they're representing the community, they back down very quickly when you tell them, well, actually, what you said here is confusing and it makes it sound like you are speaking on behalf of the whole project, but all these other people disagree with you. They often back down.
Yeah, I mean, it could be true. I'm thinking because I have a situation right now.
What I'm saying is that a lot of times when we have these problems to solve, we don't necessarily look at our legal toolbox. We look at our social toolbox instead.
Well, but
I can't believe I just said that. We look at our social toolbox.
Yeah, that was a really toolbox thing to say. But my point is that yes, I agree with you, but I mean, this is like, it's kind of like copyleft in some sense. It's the issue of when you have a community principle you're trying to uphold, having a legal backing to that will work and will be known to have worked is the only way to really do it. Because there's these people who argue that, oh, well, I mean, I have people who used to be supporters of copyleft, people who used to help me enforce GPL now say, oh, well, GPL is just a way to get people to just socially do what you want. And they're against enforcement now. But I think the only reason it works socially is because the enforcement is always there as a secondary means if the social aspects don't work. And so I think trademarks kind of have to be, if they can't be used that way, to protect projects, you know, from the...
Well, it's just so expensive to do so. So, I mean, you know, just like anything else. It's the same with copyright enforcement.
Yeah, but I think the thing Pam's right about is that projects need to do some of this, right? I mean, they need to care more about how their name's used. I really kind of agree with Pam on that. I was surprised that, I mean, I didn't think I would agree so much with her, but I kind of agree with her that projects ought to, and you were saying this somewhat too in your talk last year, that projects need to actually enforce their trademark, and not just because that it's a use it or enforce it or lose it regime, but because they should be standing up for the name that they care about. It's their identity.
Also, because the whole point of, as I said, the basis of trademark law is whether consumers will be confused. Like, you don't want people to be confused about what is coming from you and what isn't, what is from your free software project and your community and what isn't. And that's, I mean... And that's the whole thing.
Yeah, and so that's actually leads me to another thing that she talked about that kind of troubled me. But it's not her fault; it's the legal fault. And it's the same in copyright law that, at least copyright law with reference to copyleft, that the party that's harmed doesn't have the cause of action. So the consumer that's confused doesn't have a cause of action under trademark law. Just like in copyleft, the user who didn't get the source code generally doesn't have a cause of action under copyright law. What's wrong? I mean, our legal system's messed up. That the people harmed don't have the right to action under the regimes that are supposed to be protecting them.
That's a very interesting point. I hadn't thought about that parallel. That's interesting.
Because if you're just saying it's interesting, but you see what I'm saying? I mean, say
it is
more.
Interesting.
Say more. Say more about how awesome what I said is. Well, no, I just mean I want to hear what your thoughts are, just beyond interesting.
I say it's interesting because I'm thinking about it. Because
some people say things are interesting to say that they're stupid. You know that, right? Well, isn't that interesting, people say. I just make sure you're not doing that.
No, but look at that.
Yeah, this is. I'm not going to say what this is because it's an issue of ongoing action. But it is a website that's using a lot of logos of free software projects, and we at Conservancy, because some of our logos are mixed in, have determined that they have nothing to do with our projects.
What's also interesting is that logo reminds me of your logo.
Oh, that's a good point. I hadn't even thought about that.
Especially since there are. Conservancy project.
The reason I brought this up, I know we really can't talk about this because only that one's kind of GNOME related, but there's no actual GNOME in there. That's why I wanted to check because I wanted to know if I wanted to get your sort of on the air reaction to that. But yeah, I'm sorry we can't say what this site is, but there are people there who just like grab free software project logos and sort of throw them around. And this has happened to Conservancy in the past.
They did a good job.
Yeah. I mean, what this entity did is they made a conglomeration logo of their own.
In fact, that would be out great of lots for your of logo. Free software logos.
Yeah, but not.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's basically they took a lot of logos from all different free software projects and brought them together,
and it actually looks great.
I'm not convinced it looks great, but. But it's probably trademark infringement for a lot of these projects because they don't have anything to do with them and they didn't contact them or aren't working with them or anything. So.
Yeah. Well, this is, I think, pretty confusing depending on how you look at it.
But I mean, that's an interesting thing. Back to this cause of action issue. You say it's interesting, but what does that mean?
It's interesting, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I have to think about it.
Yeah.
I'm not that kind of person who just,
has a reaction to things.
Yeah.
And says it.
Because in this case, it's sort of like evaluating, well, what if we lived in an alternate world where you could... Where those people did have the right, were the right holders.
I know,
I'm sure there are negative consequences to it. Down the road of, okay, well, what if that were the case? What are the bad things that come along with it? And
I definitely don't want to do that. I cannot stand academics who, and you guys will hear some of this later in later episodes, that I just can't stand academics who are saying, the way it should be this, and we should just convince the people.
I cannot wait to have that conversation.
We'll just convince the people in power who absolutely have no reason to listen to us whatsoever, unless we have billions of dollars, which we don't, to just fix these systems and make them. Because wouldn't the systems be great if they work this way, right? And I'm just, I didn't want to take you down that road. I actually wanted to look not forward but backward at how did we end up with systems that sort of give the wrong people power.
Well, it's exactly what Pam was saying, which is that these systems were not created for free and open source software projects. These systems were created for companies producing products that they sold to the public.
Yeah, Pam did say that. That's a good point. But see, in the interesting thing is the trademark law, different than the other legal systems, actually contemplated a little bit who it was protecting, the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
These other laws don't. I mean, copyright doesn't.
Right, patents actually,
don't.
That's true. That's something that's kind of...
Actually, patent law originally did. There's a good example in patent law, which is now gone since the Patent Deform Act that was passed recently. But patent law did have false marking, and you had there was a bounty system where anybody could bring a incorrectly marked patented object. Like, so if you ever get... Like, a great example is when you get those little... Those little
sweet and low packets.
The packets of yeah.
That's
that was a great example. That was not the example I was thinking of. But anything where you get something, a physical thing that has a patent number on it or says patented and has a number, that number has to be a valid patent that's currently active. And if it's not, it's false marking. And it used to be the case that anybody could bring a false marking case against those companies. And it was like a bounty system where they had the public just monitoring this. And if somebody in the public noticed, oh, wait a second, this is falsely marked, they could bring it. They had cause of action to bring a lawsuit, which is really cool. And now it's gone. And that was actually the same solution that Larry Lessig proposed to solve spam, which was that everybody should have a cause of action against spammers.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, basically if somebody wanted to bring a cause of action against spam they received, they could bring a cause of action and then they would get the reward, the money that the spammer for the, you know, the penalty would go to the individual rather who brought the suit rather than the government to encourage people to stop spammers. But I mean, this is the.
I wish GPL enforcement worked that way. Give some rights in some ways to downstream to users by giving you the right to request the source code.
The thing
code
is, you don't have the right to enforce. You can't enforce when they say oh, I was going to use the F word, but and we don't have the marking in our little RSS feed to say I can say that. So
you can just say F you.
So anyway, but that's what they say. And then there's no cause of action. Now, the only person who's looked into this, and he's had limited success, and not great success, but some success, Brandon, Scott in Australia, used consumer fraud law in Australia to argue that somebody
interesting.
Well, no, it was good that he did that, and we looked briefly, and that was doable in the U.S. and the consumer fraud laws aren't the same. So, but I think that we want to look at ways that empower users. I mean, free software is about empowering users, and
you're right.
And I want to see trademark do that too. And one of the reasons I've never had issue with trademark is because of this thing. The reason trademark I was usually generally comfortable with is like, oh, it's about people not being confused, about people knowing that when I get Inkscape, it's Inkscape.
It is, but at the same time, it's about companies being able to control what people think about their own products. Right, it's about like Coca-Cola being certain that someone just can't order a Coke and get a Sprite.
Do you know the whole story about the 5-cent Coke?
No.
Yeah, it's off topic. I'll link to it in the show notes, but I'll tell Karen off the air because it's way off topic. But it's vaguely related to trademark. Vaguely related to trademark.
I think we actually have come to the end of what we should talk about because now I want to end the show so I can hear it.
Okay, so. Anyway, so that's the story with trademarks, and I appreciate Pam's talk.
I
think that I actually, if I can ever dig up that recording of your talk, I think listening to Pam's talk then your talk, like back to back, would be great because I think your talk fills in a lot of gaps that Pam didn't get a chance to cover, and you're covering it from a different angle.
Well, maybe I can actually give it again on the show once. Sometime.
Oh, we could do that. I think I have that recording somewhere. That's what I'm thinking. That's what I think might be true.
Okay.
So I want to thank Pam for giving that talk because I think, I mean, this will probably be a show that I point back to if people ask, like, what is trademark all about?
Yeah.
Like, this is the one we'll probably be pointing them back to. So if you're joining us because you wanted to learn about trademark and this is the first show you listen to,
welcome.
If you got to this far into the show after hearing Pam's talk. So and I want to thank Pam for giving that talk because now we've got that content that sort of introduces people to trademark that we
really
didn't
great.
Have before.
Okay.
And more FOSDEM talks
more FOSDEM
to come.
More FOSDEM to come. More heated debate, I think.
Well, that's a couple episodes away. But.
Yeah. All right. Freeze and Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Freeze and Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Freeze and Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Freeze and Freedom website, faif.us. That's FAIF.us.
We've got bars. So it's working out.
All right.